Good evening. This is the KRFP Evening Report for Wednesday, April 11th, 2012. I'm Lee Robartis. In the news tonight, ecological and agricultural activist Vandana Shiva from India is tonight's keynote Bora Symposium speaker at the University of Idaho. Daytime Bora panel tells about the variety of local small-scale agriculture on the Palouse. We'll hear what's up with the Idaho's ACLU, Megalode Monitor seatbelt infraction dismissed, and city council members not sure about low-income housing on proposed parkland on Lily Street. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The Washington State Legislature adjourned today with the second special session closing after passing a budget deal with a 44-2 vote in the Senate and a 64-34 vote in the House. The bill will close the $500 million deficit in the state budget. The new budget plan will allow the state to temporarily collect local sales taxes in order to raise $238 million. A two-thirds majority vote led to the elimination of tax deductions for some large banks. That change will allow the state to collect $14.5 million. According to Democratic Senator Ed Murray of Seattle, there will be no cuts to education under the new budget. The legislature also approved a jobs bill today, setting aside $1 billion for construction jobs. A pension reform bill led by Republicans and sponsored by Senator Joe Zirelli of Ridgefield passed with a 27-22 vote. Few Democrats voted for the bill, and only two Republicans voted against it. The bill will mean state workers hired after May 2013 will have reduced pensions by as much as 50%. Another bill passed during the special session will require all new state budgets to fall within either expected state revenue over a four-year period, or increase less than 4.5% per year. That bill is now on Governor Chris Gregoire's desk for her signature. Dr. Vandana Shiva, a world-famous environmental thinker and activist, will be the keynote speaker tonight at the University of Idaho's Bora Symposium in the Student Union Building. The topic of Dr. Shiva's address is Water Wars and the Future of Food. KRFP citizen journalist Jill Maxwell met with Shiva earlier this afternoon and asked her how she would respond to those who argue that it is only with corporate-driven, chemical-laden monoculture agriculture that we can produce enough food to feed the world.
That it's probably the biggest lie of our century. Monocultures produce much less than diverse farms do. Large farms produce much less than small farms do. Ecological agriculture produces much more than industrial farming does. Now, this data is out in the United Nations. It's out through what I call the IPCC of agriculture. It's a United Nations appointed committee 10 years after the Rio summit. And it mobilized 400 scientists who worked 4 years, read through all the peer-reviewed literature to see what is the future of agriculture. An agriculture that sustains the planet and nourishes people. And they weren't cooking up, they were reading the literature. And the fact is neither genetic engineering nor chemical farming produces food security. Genetic engineering has failed to increase yields. It's only in Monsanto's ads that is feeding the world. and chemical agriculture, chemical monocultures, as our work and our studies in India show, have much less food output than small biodiverse organic farms. If farming is done the way we practice it, we could be feeding 2 Indias, more than 2 billion people. And the United Nations put out a report last year to show how in Africa, if farming went ecological, there would be 3 times more food than Africa has. So the idea that you have to destroy the planet in order to feed people is a totally false caricature created so that the war industry of a century ago can continue to make profits while making war against the planet and people.
That was Dr. Vandana Shiva, who will be the keynote speaker at the University of Idaho's Bora Symposium tonight, speaking on water wars and the future of food. Dr. Shiva left academics to found the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology, a participatory public interest research organization. And later, when she found that global corporations wanted to patent seeds, crops, and life forms, she started the Navdanya International Institute in India to protect biodiversity, defend farmers' rights, and promote organic farming. Vandana Shiva's speech will begin at 7 p.m. in the Student Union Building Ballroom on the University of Idaho campus at 6th and Deacon Streets in Moscow. The event is free and open to the public. Three local organic growers told a Bora Symposium panel today about the various styles of farming they practice because of their initial desire to be a part of sustainable agriculture. Kate Jekyll, who only farms on a half an acre on the Palouse, grows fruit trees, strawberries, and raspberries, and produces year-round greens in unheated greenhouses, including spinach, kale, and other winter greens. Jekyll and her family sell at the Moscow Saturday Farmers Market. She said there isn't a whole lot of waste on her farm, and they do a lot of fermenting of excess crops, such as making sauerkraut. Jekyll spoke of the national food system in the United States during the panel discussion.
Our farming capabilities are huge, and we can produce enough food for our entire population, but at this point, half of what is produced in this country through agriculture is wasted. A lot of waste happens in the field because it's not perfect enough to be showing it at a grocery store, but half of the food that you see on the shelf will eventually end up being wasted. A lot of fresh produce is just thrown away. We see 96 billion pounds of food in this country every year thrown in the dumpster, which is an incredible amount when you think about world hunger and the incredible need for food. It really wouldn't be that hard of a stretch for grocery stores to be making links to people in need.
That was local grower Kate Jekyll. Sequoia Ladd, who farms on 6 acres with her family near Moscow, says she sells anything that isn't eaten by her family to people by word of mouth. Ladd says she is involved in a culture of farming that emphasizes natural processes.
But my personal view on permaculture, and this is not what you're going to find in a book, is that it's an amalgamation of sustainable systems design from cultures all over the world. Bill Mollison and David Holmgren came up with it. They're Australians. It's brilliant. I had a chance to talk to David at a conference years ago, and he really made a point that they didn't come up with anything new. What they did was they studied cultures all over the world. It wasn't cultural appropriation. It was, here is what works. Here are some of the patterns. See if you can make it work in these different areas. And the big deal with permaculture is that it's earth care, people care, and fair share. And fair share is actually distributing surplus. And with permaculture, every bioregion will have a different design system that will work for that locality. And so, you know, if you know anything about it, people are all into food forests. Food forests aren't going to work very well here. We grow grass really well. You're going to have different systems here. You know, if you put in an herb spiral, it doesn't make your garden a permaculture garden. You've got a design for your area and your region.
That was local grower Sequoia Ladd. Ladd said it's important for small farmers to avoid debt, not just financial debt, but ecological debt. She also says they should have in place redundancies that will help the farm should crops fail or animals die.
You wake up one morning, all the lettuce seedlings that you planted over the last 3 weeks are toast. It's a good thing you planted something else because something just came in and ate them all and you get to start over. I just had that happen 2 days ago. that happens. It's part of farming, and you have to prepare for that. So you always build in some redundancy.
The grower on today's panel with the largest farm, Cheryl Hagen Zachariasen, said there's a contradiction between production efficiency and taking care of the land. Hagen Zachariasen said she and her family want to leave their 600-acre farm in better shape than when they got it.
In some ways, if you look around, especially this March, we've had an overdose of water, and there's erosion, and so it seems like it would be a no-brainer to leave the land in better shape than it was. It's so hard. It's so hard. Because the other thing is that the soil especially is so complex and we know so little about it.
Hagen Zachariasen grows oilseed crops, grains, and hay for farm animals. She says she sells within an 80-mile radius and has refused customers who have come from farther away, telling them they should find someone closer. The 2012 Borah Symposium concludes with sustainable farming activist Vandana Shiva, who will speak tonight at the University of Idaho Student Union Building Ballroom at 7 p.m. KRFP citizen journalist Jen Bobier assisted with this story. American Civil Liberties Union organizer Brad Rudley told the Moscow League of Women Voters today that all Idaho counties fall far short in standards for indigent defense set by the National Legal Aid and Defenders Association, meaning many defendants who can't afford their own attorneys end up taking a settlement when accused of a crime they did not commit. Rudley said the state of Idaho does not give any money to indigent defense, so counties around the state pay for it all with differing but mostly poor results.
Nez Perce, Bonneville, and Canyon County have no workload controls or monitoring of private caseloads, so an attorney can take on as many cases as they're assigned, and they can also carry a private caseload with their own clients. In Bonneville County, a single attorney is assigned to handle more than 4 full-time attorneys worth of work, and this allows 1 hour of work per client. Also, Bonneville County only has $6,000 a year for investigations, investigators, and those guys are not cheap. And Ada County felony cases equal 952 cases per lawyer per year. And the DOJ standard was 150, so you can see this is way above it. And it allows each lawyer to spend roughly 2.18 hours on each case. And then additionally, the lawyers only have 2 hours on misdemeanors. In our county, felony caseloads are 150 to 270% of 150 cases, so roughly 200 to 350 cases, felony cases a year, and same with misdemeanors. So you can see we're about double, close to double in Kootenai County. And Canyon County, about the same picture as Kootenai.
That was Brad Rudley, who's an organizer with the American Civil Liberties Union of Idaho. He's based in Moscow. He spoke to the Moscow League of Women Voters Wednesday noontime speaker series this afternoon. Judge Robert Caldwell in Coeur d'Alene today dismissed a seatbelt infraction against Wild Idaho Rising Tide activist Helen Yost of Moscow. Yost was arrested August 27th, the day after about 150 people swarmed Washington Street in Moscow and stopped a giant oversized ExxonMobil tar sands shipment, resulting in 6 arrests. She and 3 other women were monitoring the megalode the night after the arrests in Kootenai County and were stopped along the shoulder of U.S. 95 when they were approached by Idaho State Trooper Ronald Sutton. Yost and co-defendant Courtney C.C. Clare were accused of not wearing their seatbelts in a moving vehicle, and when they failed to produce identification, were arrested for misdemeanor obstruction. Yost told KRFP what happened in court today.
He seemed to think that he and the prosecutor, which represents the state, they seem to think they had pretty good evidence in that they submitted three pictures that we had never seen. We got to see them briefly on the way to being submitted as evidence. And the trooper alleged that there was so much stuff on the back seat that there's no way we could have had our seatbelts on. And so he took these pictures like sort of standing behind, you know, with the door open, standing behind the driver's seat. And in the end, the judge, looking at the picture, said, you know, he was anticipating seeing a lot more junk on the seat. And there wasn't anything he thought that he saw there that, you know, couldn't be moved would represent an obstacle to wearing one's seatbelt. And the trooper also didn't seem to remember having taken out my sort of cloth satchel that I had a bunch of papers in and cell phone and other things. He didn't initially seem to remember taking that out and setting them on the hood of the trooper car while I was already cuffed in the back and going through that to look for my ID, which, you know, I unfortunately gave him permission to do that. And so, of course, our question was, did you take that picture before you took that satchel that you seemed to think was in the way of the seatbelt out, or did you take it after? And he wasn't able to even recall that very clearly as well.
And getting off on the seatbelt charge, which isn't even a misdemeanor, wouldn't that help your case in the obstruction charge, because these two charges are related?
Well, actually, yes. We already had a pretrial hearing that was actually before a judge instead of just, you know, the prosecuting and defending attorneys getting together. It was a motion to suppress, and it was based primarily on the notion that that an officer really doesn't have a right to ask for your ID unless he suspects you've committed some kind of crime. And so it was purely speculation on the officer's part that we had not had our seatbelts on when the car is in motion, because he, in fact, approached the vehicle. It was an SUV parked supposedly in an emergency lane on a divided access highway. He you know, was trying to say that we didn't have the seatbelts on while the car was in motion, even though he had approached the car while it had already been stopped and we'd already taken off our seatbelts.
So for the public listening, this is even a stronger indication that the police were out to harass tar sands shipment monitors.
Yeah, we didn't address the contextual situation as much during the motion to suppress. However, it did come out mightily in this particular trial, and the prosecution even tried to block some of the questioning going on at one point when I mentioned that cameras had even been set up on Highway 12 to run license plates, and that officers routinely, any people around the megaloads on Highway 12 and 95, as far as we could tell, were running license plates on people. And so we argued that the officers already knew who was in that car, and they were just looking for, you know, any reason to ask for our ID and verify that the people they thought were in the car were in the car. And this all happened on the night after our really big demonstration at the end of August, which was very successful. And we suspect that the combined police community had an axe to grind in that, you know, we had pulled off a demonstration successfully the night before, and that they somehow perceived me as at least the communicator, if not the leader of the organization that staged the demonstration, in that I was always, and still am, the one that sends out notices about protests. So we suspect, and this came out in testimony, that they were purposely looking for, you know, people that were associated with Wild Idaho Rising Tide. And the irony is that, you know, we never in our two interactions with Idaho State Police that night ever said anything about who we were or what we were doing. And yet on the police report, at the very top in the heading, it says Megaload Protesters.
Why would the prosecution want to suppress the information about the license plate reader cameras on U.S. Highway 12?
I am not entirely sure, but I guess it would show that there was a prejudice against certain users of our own highways going on among our own law enforcement or officers. And, you know, a certain amount of harassment, intimidation, targeting, all of that played even into this minor seatbelt ticket.
Okay, anything else you want to add?
Well, we are a little bit disappointed that this ruling from the judge, who said there wasn't enough evidence and that the state would purely be speculating whether I had my seatbelt on while the rig was moving or not, we wish that the judge had dismissed this infraction ticket, only a $10 seatbelt ticket, before our motion to suppress, in that, you know, that was the foundation for that argument. But, you know, you take what victories you get as you get them, and now we just feel that this lays a stronger foundation for the misdemeanor case, that the trial for that will be next month.
And that was Helen Yost of Wild Idaho Rising Tide speaking with us at KRFP later this afternoon. You're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP in Moscow. State legislators in Idaho recently received Ku Klux Klan literature in the mail. Now the Attorney General's office is monitoring a number of reports coming from Idaho's state lawmakers who received the mail from the KKK, although the leader of the white supremacy group claims no involvement. The letters include a newsletter and membership application and ask people to join the Ku Klux Klan. One of the legislators who received one of the letters was Democratic Representative Cherie Buckner Webb of Boise, who is the only African-American lawmaker in the Idaho legislature. The only Republican to receive the letter was Representative Tom Trail of Moscow. Knights of the Ku Klux Klan National Director Thomas Robb was listed as signing the letters, but he has denied having anything to do with them. The letters say membership packets are available on the group's website. The Montgomery, Alabama-based Southern Poverty Law Center, which tracks hate group organizing in the U.S., says there are 18 hate groups in Idaho. The incident is being taken so seriously by the state because of the troubled history in Idaho's past dealing with white supremacy groups like the disbanded Aryan Nations. Trail told the Daily News if the mailing was intended to intimidate a cross-section of Idaho lawmakers, it will have the opposite effect. He said they're going to get mad and the whole state is going to be on alert. Trail added, I think it's very positive. It continually keeps people alert of these organizations and the threat they pose. Moscow police arrested two men who live in the city yesterday for recent vehicle robberies on the University of Idaho campus, 25-year-old Jesse R. Phillips and 24-year-old Justin C. Ryan are currently being held at the Latah County Jail. The men were arrested Monday in connection with a number of vehicle burglaries in the last month occurring on the University of Idaho campus. The Pullman City Council voted yesterday to appoint Associated Students of Washington State University Vice President Derek Skaug to replace Council Member Keith Bloom. The City Council performed 9 interviews before deciding on Skaug. Skaug will assume the council's at-large position. Skaug, who is a political science major, had also applied for former council member Barney Waldrop's ward position in February. Skaug said in his interview one of his reasons for seeking a city council position is to encourage students to stay in Pullman year-round. Skaug said having 30-50% of students in the city during the summer would change the way the town's economy functions. Skaug also said he would take into account the needs of all citizens. The Healthy Youth Survey, taken anonymously by high school students on their use of alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs, shows Clarkston School District is more at risk than neighboring school districts. A high-risk ranking will likely bring a grant to focus on prevention and use of substances. The high-risk rank puts Clarkston School District in the top 25% of school districts in the state of Washington. By comparison, the Assotin Annatone School District received an average risk ranking for alcohol consumption. Moscow City Council members on the Administrative Committee were leery of a proposal by Moscow Affordable Housing Trust to build 2 homes on property the city had acquired along a railroad route between Lily and Asbury Streets. Under the plan, the homes would be available for sale to people or families who earn between 50% and 80% of the annual median income for the region. At Monday's meeting, Councilmember Tom Lamar noted the city had purchased the land that connects the Lilly and Asbury sections of the railroad corridor for a recreation path and possibly for parkland.
Acquisition of this property was to help us get the path through this area, but I also saw value in, when we acquired it, for some parkland to help satisfy the families in the area, and I guess that would go away.
Mayor Nancy Cheney also indicated she would like the city to develop the property into a future park. However, Councilmember Wayne Krause said he sees some benefit in following through with the Affordable Housing Trust's plan.
One thing that we have a shortage of is money for parks development. We already have some parks that we're trying to get developed, and we can. And this is an additional one. Now, as my understanding is that as you pay the city the lease for this, it's going to come back to help compensate the city for the purchase of the property eventually, originally.
Correct.
So then that money, I would guess, Gary, would budget-wise go back into the Parks and Recreation budget.
Actually, the funding began in the general fund capital and was transferred into Parks and Rec.
Okay, but it could then that money could then be utilized for improvement of the path in that area and beautification of that particular area.
That was Moscow City Councilmember Wayne Krause. You also heard from Moscow City Supervisor Gary Riedner during that clip. Administrative committee members said the issue deserves more discussion, and Riedner said he would take the issue to the Moscow Parks and Recreation Commission for input. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Take a look at the weather from the National Weather Service. 70% chance of showers and possibly a thunderstorm tonight. Cloudy with a low around 39. West winds 10 to 15, gusts up to 25 miles per hour. A 50% chance of showers tomorrow, mainly after noon. Mostly cloudy, high 52. South winds 5 to 10 with gusts up to 25 miles an hour. Tomorrow night, 30% chance of showers before midnight, mostly cloudy, low 34. 20% chance of showers on Friday, mostly cloudy, high 53, mostly cloudy Friday night, 35 for the low. A 20% chance of showers in the afternoon on Saturday, but mostly sunny, high 53, partly cloudy Saturday night, low 36, and sunny, high near 60 on Sunday. Currently, some haze in the area, 52 degrees. Thanks for tuning in to the KRFP Evening Report. Coming up next, we'll have Building Bridges, the weekly labor report from Pacifica Radio, followed by Flashpoints, the daily investigative news magazine, also from Pacifica Radio at 6:30. At 7:30, World Waves with World Music, Catherine Bonzo, on the air, and music and entertainment programming throughout the evening right here on KRFP Moscow, listener-supported community radio. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on Radio Free Moscow, be sure to become a member of Radio Free Moscow. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students. You can mail your memberships to Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or check out the Radio Free Moscow website to find more ways to donate to Radio Free Moscow and listen to archived editions of the KRFP Evening Report, or if you missed today's edition. This is KRFP Moscow. I'm Lee Robartis, Samantha Stauffenberg, and Jill Maxwell assisted with tonight's newscast. Also, Craig Wheeler assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. KRFP Moscow.